Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It was March 24th when the first Iowan died of COVID-19. In the past few weeks, the number of cases in Iowa has skyrocketed. Over the last few days, we've averaged around 10,000 tests administered statewide every day, with nearly half of them coming back positive. Hospitals are being stretched to the limit, and so are doctors, nurses, and other caregivers. Moments ago, we learned that we're very close to another grim milestone. That number, 2,000. Right now, we know that 1,991 Iowans have died of COVID-19. As the numbers climb, more and more Iowans are being touched by the disease. My family is no exception. My brother, who's a high school teacher, and my sister-in-law, who's a school-based translator, both have the virus. In this hour, I'll talk with two survivors of COVID-19 and a man who lost both of his grandparents to the virus on the same day. We also want to hear your stories this hour. You can join us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My first guest today is Courtney Crowder. She is the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register, and she, along with many other journalists, has been telling the stories of those lost to this virus in a project called Iowa Mourns. They're helping us remember and understand that the statistics we report each day are referring to human beings, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, and friends. Courtney, hello.
Hi, Charity. How are you today?
I'm all right. Thank you so much for being here today. And I'm sure many Iowans have been spending a lot of time reading some of the articles you and many others have written for Iowa Mourns. Tell me just a little bit about the idea behind this project.
Sure. So early on, March 24th, like you said, was the first death that occurred in Iowa. And early on, we just didn't know who these people were who were dying from this disease that's shapeless, faceless, nameless, just kind of all around us. And the fear was really palpable. So in the beginning, there would be a death that hits, you know, Facebook, and all of a sudden we swarm it. We have that one story, and we were just hungry for those stories. But over time, I started noticing that obituaries were saying COVID-19 was the cause of death. And I said, we could do something with these names and with these people and with these stories. They are publicly out there as having died of COVID-19, so we don't have to deal with FOIAs or requesting anything, and we can tell their stories. And I really based the idea of the project on the Portraits of Grief series, which the New York Times did after 9/11. I went to NYU in the years after 9/11, and I remember the hole where the World Trade Center used to be very distinctly in my mind. We used to go on a sky bridge across it to get to the movie theater. And I remember reading those portraits and just being so moved, because everything about them made their death secondary. They were about the people that lived, the people that did things, the people who had cool, weird, outrageous things in their life that were worth remembering. And so we really got together as a series of newsrooms and said, how can we take that idea that the death, which we know is horrendous, and we know they were probably alone, how can we make the death secondary and really bring the life to the forefront of the Iowans that we're losing?
Well, and you mentioned that COVID-19 is being cited as a cause of death in a lot of obituaries, but we also know that many Iowans have died of COVID-19 and their families aren't sharing that information. When you reach out to families to talk about the loved ones who have died, do you find a discomfort in talking about it openly?
Yes. I would say we're at like a 50-50% rate. When I call people, half the time they immediately start telling stories and are so glad that someone has given them a platform and an opportunity to talk about their mother, father, sister, brother, daughter. And about half the time, people are just scared of how polarized this has become politically. And so their fear is that even if they are sharing about life, and even if they are telling stories, their mother, father, brother, sister, daughter becomes a political football. Mm-hmm. And that's been less of a problem as the project has come out, because people now see that we are not, you know, secretly going to use this in a story to slam anyone. We're really here to tell about life. So we have more people who say yes, but yeah, I mean, people are scared to have their loved one's memory become polarized.
And I can imagine there are also some people who just really want people to know about this loss in the hopes that it'll help others.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. I mean, that's the other side of it, is that people want to share so that, number one, frankly, their loved one is remembered as more than a number. And I think you see that in a lot of disasters, but especially in something like 9/11, or here in this pandemic, we have these charts that come out that just have graphs and numbers and lines, and the humanity is sucked out of them, if I could be so bold. Yeah. They're just really so black and white and bare, and people want to fill that in with color and fill that in with lives. But then they also, yeah, there are people who hope that if they read about their loved one, maybe they'll wear a mask the next time they go to Walmart.
Let's talk for a few minutes about some of the people that you have written about recently. I have really, really appreciated this series, Courtney, and I love to celebrate the lives of some really wonderful and fascinating Iowans that you've written about. One of the most recent stories was so captivating about Ed Davis. He was a World War II Marine. Tell me about Ed Davis.
Yeah, Ed was amazingly captivating. Ed was from rural Iowa, state center eventually, and he signed up for World War II following his three brothers into the Marines. The Marines, of course, were in the Pacific, so he was sent as a private first-class rifleman to Island Hop, to American Victory. And if you know anything about the Pacific, that is really hand-to-hand combat. I mean, that is bayonets. That is jumping from island to island, cave to cave, soldier to soldier. And that is hard battle. And he did that for close to 9 months until the bomb was dropped and the war was ended. He was actually fighting still when the war ended, quote-unquote. I'm using air quotes. Because to them, the war didn't end for a few more days, because Japanese soldiers had to be told, like the news hadn't reached the Japanese side, that they were surrendering. So for a few days after it reached the American side, Japanese soldiers were still fighting. And after the war, he moved to China. He was redeployed to China to help the Chinese sort of rout out the Japanese in their country. So the Chinese were having their own civil war at the time between communism and the Chiang Kai-shek regime, and they weren't really a part of that. Ed used to say, like, we didn't have anything really to do with that. Our job was to get the Japanese out and get them back home. So he was actually there, and we have a photo of him in the background when the Japanese are surrendering to the Chinese in what is now Beijing.
Wow.
He really, I mean, all of that happened before he was 21 years old.
My goodness. And you spent a lot of time talking to one of his daughters, right?
Yes. Yeah. And she is representative of a lot of the people that we talked to we talked for 2 hours, who just tell story after story after story. And she texted me, you know, right after we hung up after talking for 2 hours and was like, I forgot to tell you how good a whistler he was. You know, we used to get lost in stores and we'd find each other by whistling. And so these survivors, as we call them, surviving loved ones, they just want to make sure that their mother, father, brother, sister is remembered. And these people have done amazing things, like Ed Davis. And if I could, Charity, I just want to say this too. In writing about Ed, I learned just how quickly we are losing our World War II veterans. The Veterans Administration says we lose about more than 200 World War II veterans a day. And that was prior to this pandemic, which, of course, we know is hitting the elderly. So the people who fought in that, you know, great war, the war we talk about as being central to our culture today, we are losing them, and we're losing them exponentially. And for me, you know, I think about Iowa Mourns and I want to tell every story, but now I want to tell those stories especially, because it's like capturing them forever.
Yeah. Well, and Ed Davis was an older man, obviously. He was born in 1925, so he was 95 years old. And a lot of the people that you write about are elderly. We know that COVID-19 is killing our elderly at really a remarkable rate, but you're writing about people of all ages.
We are. We have someone who was 36 who died, Abby. Abby was a beloved member of the Better Business Bureau in Des Moines, a lifelong Southsider, and someone who absolutely loved Legos, absolutely loved fall, absolutely loved corn mazes, who was in her young, just 8 years of marriage, so a young relationship. And she really had the rest of her life set out before her. And so we absolutely have those names, the names of people who are in their 30s who die. You know, Abby was healthy and she was dead within 4 days. And we hear those stories too.
Yeah, obviously that happens a lot less often, but it does happen. And that I think a lot of people want to deny that that is happening. But for the families that have lost a loved one who is in their 30s or 40s or 50s, it's just absolutely devastating. And Courtney, we are going to need to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Courtney Crowder. She's the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. And she, along with many other journalists, has been telling the stories of those lost to COVID-19 in a project called Iowa Mourns. And of course, you can find that at the Des Moines Register. We're going to talk more about her experiences and some of the stories that she has told. We're also going to talk with a number of other people about their experiences with COVID-19. I'll talk with a survivor who spent 25 days in the hospital, another COVID survivor, and also a young man who lost both of his grandparents on the same day. And we want to hear about your experiences. We know that so many Iowans have been touched by COVID now. Tell us your story. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps training program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about what you are experiencing with COVID-19 right now as case numbers have skyrocketed in Iowa. We see our hospitals stretched to the limit, our nurses, our doctors also stretched to the limit. And it feels like more and more of us have been touched by this virus because we have. We're going to talk with a number of people who have experienced COVID-19 this hour, and we also want to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Courtney Crowder. She's the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register and the woman behind the project Iowa Mourns, remembering so many of these people who have been lost to COVID-19 in Iowa. And I want to turn now to Nathan Lair. And of course, we know that early in the pandemic, the vast majority of COVID cases were in urban areas of the state. But COVID-19 is now raging in rural parts of Iowa. Cases are rising rapidly and dramatically in Jones County. One day last week, the county positivity rate was over 90%. Nathan Lair lives in Anamosa in Jones County. He is a COVID survivor. Hello, Nathan.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here, and I'm so glad you are here. Nathan, even before COVID hit, 2020 was a tough year for your family. Your wife has been going through cancer treatment.
Yeah, that started a year ago in March, where she was first diagnosed, and it was considered to be somewhat aggressive. So she's been on the full the full chemo circuit and her hair loss, and she went through the wig stage, and she kept her chin up the entire time. But been going through just the chemo itself on a regular basis, and then this year came around where we were looking forward to get rid of last year, and in the middle of her chemo, the COVID decided to take a visit.
Wow. So tell us what happened. I mean, you got diagnosed with COVID?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a strange. They weren't going to give me the test originally because I didn't meet the criteria, which was going around quite a bit then. You had to have a certain criteria before they would even give you a test. And because at the time, my temperature was going all over the place, and at the time I took the test or went in to take the test, my temperature was not high, but it had been. And the only reason they gave me a test was because my wife was on chemo, which made her a super high risk. So because of her, they gave me the test. And once they gave me the test, it came back positive. And up to that point, I had been bedridden for 3 solid days. Just only reason I got up was to go to the bathroom, and I went straight back to bed again. And it felt like I was just taking a nap, but my naps were 20 hours at a time.
Oh, wow.
I had absolutely no appetite whatsoever. I couldn't taste anything when I did try to take a nibble, but it was just the most lethargic experience at that point in time. And when we did find out that I tested positive, I remember telling my wife at the time that at least now I know what we're facing, because up to then I would not, you know, if it wasn't that, I don't know what it is.
Right.
But it was an extreme. Even when we waited another 2 days after it came back positive to see what I was going to do, if it was going to go up or down. Well, it never went up. I just stayed in bed. And finally, she decided enough is enough, took me to Mercy Hospital here in Cedar Rapids, and we did not know what to expect. She stayed in the car in the parking lot because they would not let her in, and it was a 3 or 4 hour ordeal for me, going through test after test after test and blood tests and all types of different things, and then come to find out they were not going to allow me to go in except for the very last test was a test on my lungs, and they found I had double pneumonia. And that's what got me admitted.
Wow. And Nathan, when did all of this happen?
This began in the first week of March, and I spent a week they isolate you because I was already COVID positive. So they put me on 9th floor of the Mercy, and they dedicated the entire floor to COVID patients in preparation for what was they were expecting to be a bit of a wave to come in. And it was a week that I was in there. There's a pill. I remember President Trump made it controversial at the time, that if you took this pill, it would knock it out. Well, come to find out that I can't remember the name of it, but it was supposed to be used at the onset of it, and they used it for me as a last resort, and it did not do anything. You had to be on it for 5 days. Before the 5 days was up, I was on the ventilator. So I remember before they put me on the vent, they were so somber, and I was pretty much in a daze. At that point, I'd been on morphine, and later they added fentanyl to the morphine, and my memory of the details of a timeline still are not connecting all the dots.
Sure.
I was in such a mental state at that time, but it was not a pleasant time for me. The very first day that I was on the ventilator, I crashed.
Wow. And you were in the hospital for a total of 25 days.
Yes. 7 of those were on the ventilator. The rest of the time, they were trying to get my body to remember what it used to do because the ventilator erased it.
How are you feeling now? I mean, that was back in March and April, but I know so many people who have survived COVID still struggle with some of the long-term effects.
Throughout my time in recovery, time and time again, I do remember this. Different doctors would come to my bedside, and they would tell me they are stunned at how I bounce back. They've not seen anybody bounce back like I bounce back, and they had no explanation.
Wow.
Why I wasn't struggling as much as other people were. And as time went on, I could not understand why they kept saying that. I felt like somebody threw a horse on top of me the entire time I was on recovery. And I kept telling the doctors that. Well, I tried to tell the doctors that. At the time that I was, the entire 25 days, I had no voice. It was a whisper at best because of the trach that I had in my throat. It stretched or damaged, which I'm still not sure exactly what all went on with that. But I did come out afterwards my wife's going to shoot me. I can't remember what it was called, but it's basically a blister on my vocal cord. And they said they were going to have to go in and operate and take it out. And that was planned. I had to go in for a test, a test, make sure that I could handle it. The test that I was supposed to take prior to that was the day after derecho hit.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I know that the derecho was just one of those things where everybody felt like, now more? Are you kidding?
Yeah, exactly. Pile more on top of it.
So do you have a message for Iowans right now? I mean, here we are experiencing these rates of this virus that have just climbed and climbed, and still so many people in the state don't want to take basic precautions. What would you tell people?
There's a couple things that had come to mind. My takeaways. Your previous guest, Courtney, I think her name was, very impressed with what the Des Moines Register wants to do. I think too many people are getting swallowed up in the negativity of what this thing is doing. And I think that if we could just turn our focus on what is actually happening on the other side. I had angels coming to my doorstep and dropping off supper for my family, knock on the door and leave. Never saw a face, never saw a car. And that went on for 3 months, even after I was out of the hospital. And then the other piece was the nursing staff at where I was. You're not only in the hospital, you're separated from your family. So for 25 days, I didn't even see my wife. We've been married for 32 years. And that was extremely difficult. And the nurses at that place were above your average individual. And I had told them when I was there, I don't understand why you guys are treating me like royalty. I don't get it. I don't know why you're even here. They are not assigned to the COVID floor. They are volunteering to go to the COVID floor. And I had told them, I'm not here because I chose to. You are. And it was just so moving to see. And a lot of them were, I'm 59, and a lot of them were young enough to be my kids. And they just had a heart for, they really didn't have a straight up answer. They would just kind of blow you, you know, just brush it off. It's all, no big deal. But then I had talked to their boss, and I told her the same thing. And she said, you need to understand, when you are in that line of work, it is not a job. It is not a choice. It's a calling. And I just kind of took that with me, knowing that those people there are the most comforting people that I have ever encountered. And it was a joy to be around them. And I harassed them as much as I possibly could with no voice.
So grateful for the nurses and the doctors who cared for you. I know you also found some inspiration and comfort in a kind of unlikely place in the sidewalk chalk art that you could see from your window.
They didn't know that we were watching, but we watched them I mean, the nurses lined up at the windows and looked down, and you could tell they were moved by that. I wasn't moved by that. It was right outside my window that we would do it. And I was taking pictures with my phone and sending them to my wife and that kind of thing. But when they painted those pictures on the chalk, it really moved me because I knew on a personal level who those people were that they were. They were just a face to most people with a mask over their face. I knew who they were. I mean, I saw them every day. They're the ones that pulled me out from under that cover of death. And there was another thing that was going on that I don't know if everybody is aware of. I'm assuming it's continuing because Iowa is increasing in numbers in this mess. But there was a particular church. I'm not involved with it. I don't attend it. But somehow my name got put on their list, and they literally do a drive around. And I think it was every Friday night. And they would do a convoy. And there'd be like 40, 50 cars that would drive around the hospitals, and they would have a Facebook thing where you could hear them praying over people. And to see that, I know a lot of people believe in God, a lot of people don't, but that's not what this is really about. But I, for one, cannot tell you that God does not exist when I think I am a walking proof that he does. When my wife got the call from the doctor, the day I crashed, that was on the first day they put me on the vent, the doctor called her and he said, we can't do anything more for him. The only thing, and we are so sorry to even tell you this, but the only thing that we can advise you at this point is you might want to get a hold of a funeral.
Oh, wow.
And instead, she called my brothers, and they dropped everything. And I talked to them afterwards, and they were torn because you can't come. You can't come see me. And they can't go. At the time, everything was under quarantine, so they couldn't go to my wife's house or my house. And so they just stopped in the road where they were. And they held hands. And they called their friends. And all at the same moment, everybody was calling everybody to pray for me as an individual. And I was out. That's not like I knew what was going on. By the time I came out from under the vent, the risk of me dying had already passed. I did not know anything. In fact, my wife didn't even tell me anything until the very last week that I was in the hospital, when she could actually come finally see me, because they finally released me from ICU. And once my head cleared that last week, she gave me her phone and showed me the text messages that of the progression of how things had transpired. And I understood why the doctors kept telling me what they were telling me, as far as they couldn't believe my turnaround.
So much love and so much caring. Nathan, before we run out of time, you mentioned that artwork to us and how much that meant to you and how much that meant to the nurses. We only have about a minute here, but we actually found one of the women who was painting or drawing that sidewalk chalk. Kathy Kyle is also on the line with us here. And Nathan, since that meant so much to you to see that artwork, what would you like to tell Kathy?
You have no idea. I know you felt a drive, a inner voice that was inspiring you to do what you did. But you have no idea of the effect that little thing that you would do all by yourself, nobody around, just you in your car, on the with your chalk, and the nurses. You could see the single tears going down their cheeks where they found somebody that they could connect with, because they couldn't get out of COVID until the end of their shift either. But to see what you did, no words, just pictures, and it was something that I just stared at. That was all I had. Look out my window, and in the space that my drug had me in, I stared at that thing. And just was in awe to see that there are still angels among us.
Well, Kathy, thank you for being here. Thank you for your artwork. And we only have about a minute left, but that must feel so good to know that you touched people.
Oh, man, it's humbling. You know, I called trying to, and Nathan, I'm so glad you're well, and I hope your wife continues to fight the fight. But I wanted to do something, you know, and there just wasn't anything I could really do. And there were other people that helped as well, you know, and everybody never dreamed that we wanted to show some support, but that's a lot of parking lot and just a few people. You know, we really wanted to have more of an impact, and we never knew or expected that anyone would see them. And there were a few people that would come up and say things, but it took, especially with so many unknowns, it still takes so much courage to don all that protective gear. And
Kathy, we're out of time, but I'm so glad that you know you touched people, and thank you for doing something so kind. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation ICOR Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, what we're experiencing with COVID in Iowa right now. With me is Courtney Crowder. She's the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. And she, along with many other journalists, are telling stories of Iowans lost to COVID-19 through the project called Iowa Mourns. We'd love to hear from you this hour as well, your experiences. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. And next on the line is Adam Skibbe of Iowa City. He lost both of his grandparents on the same day. Norris, or Nori, and Jane Gronert of Marion, Iowa, succumbed to COVID-19 2 hours apart on Wednesday, November 11th at Keystone Cedars Assisted Living Center in Cedar Rapids. Adam, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you so much for being here, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Tell me just a little bit about your grandparents.
You know, Grandma and Grandpa were Iowans through and through. They were very loving grandparents, and they really were the rock of that side of the family. We would see them multiple times a year. You know, it was one of those things. I'm 40, and up until a couple of years ago, they hosted every single Christmas gathering and every single Thanksgiving gathering with basically, you know, their four daughters and all of the extended family. And they were just great, great people. Just great people.
They were living together in a care facility, and we know that's been a place where there has been so much loss during this time. How did your family deal with that threat and the difficulty in actually seeing your loved ones with all the COVID restrictions?
Yeah, it was rough. They actually only moved into Keystone last year, I believe it was last summer. My grandmother was having memory issues, and Nori was having to take care of her, so they needed a little extra help. So it's particularly sad that it happened this way because it was so soon after they got to their new home. But we would see them before COVID, we would visit, and when Nori had his 90th birthday, we did a drive-by parade. Fortunately, they had a balcony facing the street, so all of us got together and we printed our signs and drove and honked. And then afterwards, this was fairly early on when things were a little less understood, but we were distanced outside in masks and, you know, shouting up at them and talking as much as we could with a 90-year-old man who has a hearing aid.
From a balcony, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so we tried our best on that. And my parents and in smaller groups would visit them. Nori would, you know, they could meet outside occasionally when they weren't locked down and that sort of thing. But it was rough. I mean, we certainly followed all the guidelines.
Yeah. And then what happened at this point? They, after all of those months of being careful, they both contracted the virus.
Yeah. So what happened, I guess they had a little outbreak or whatever kind of an outbreak at Keystone. And, you know, as a family, we collectively just were holding our breath. And we found out Grandma had it. And I wrote down a little timeline. It looks like she was taken to the hospital on October 26th. And they evaluated her. And within a couple of days, they checked her back out. There was nothing that she needed to be directly treated for at that point. And I guess they figured that Grandpa had already been exposed at that point, just having, you know, lived in a small apartment with her. But they kept checking, and he kept testing negative. And then, you know, about a week later, he tested positive. And, you know, he went pretty quick after that. It was, he actually passed before she did, you know, and it was within a couple of hours, but he got sick pretty bad. They were, I should back up. She did start slipping again before he tested positive. And, they determined hospice at that point was pretty much her option. Mm-hmm. So she had entered hospice care, and shortly thereafter he tested positive. And, you know, the illness combined with just the, I think just the overall mood around everything and the, you know, being cooped up and having to deal with the exhaustion of everything this year. And I don't think any of that helped. Yeah. But he basically, they were able to lay down in the same bed in their house and their apartment. And on the 11th in the morning, they both passed.
Well, I'm so glad they were together, Adam, but I'm so sorry for your family's loss. And I mean, what a tremendous loss that is. Adam, thank you for talking with us.
Yes, absolutely.
Courtney Crowder is still here as well from the Des Moines Register. And Courtney, you must hear from a lot of people who have lost their loved ones in care facilities. We were talking earlier about Ed Davis, yeah. And he was lost in a care facility. What a devastating time.
Yeah, and I think that isolation is something that many of the surviving loved ones talk about being almost the hardest part of the whole thing, that they couldn't be there, they couldn't hold hands, they couldn't, you know, just help them in that path as they die. And that seems to be the most difficult part. And I think the other thing, Adam sort of mentioned it, we're going to see, I think, as studies continue, how the isolation affects the other side, the person who has the disease. Because so often, that feeling of being alone, that feeling of being just by yourself, we're hearing from loved ones that they believe it hastened the disease. This is not a medical opinion.
Right.
Not a medical opinion, but just something they believe.
Right. Being alone is hard. And we're headed toward the holiday season. A lot of people are going to have to be alone to be safe. And we're going to have to work hard to reach out to the people that we love, not physically, but somehow to make sure they don't feel as alone. Of course, a lot of people have not lost loved ones, but they have lived through this disease. And that is incredibly difficult, even if you don't wind up in the hospital. Kara McFerrin is a city council member in West Liberty. She is a mother and a business owner and a COVID survivor. Kara, hello.
Hello.
Hi, and we don't have a lot of time left this hour, but I would love for you to share your story with us, because I think that you've had an experience that so many Iowans are having and will have of getting COVID-19 and trying to get through it.
Yes, thanks for inviting me, Charity. This is kind of a neat surprise to be on to kind of tell my story, but I just wanted to say that, yeah, I did have an experience where I was directly impacted by the COVID experience. I had a full knee replacement surgery on the beginning of August that was actually supposed to be scheduled earlier in the year, but got postponed. So at the beginning of August, when I went in, everything was successful, and I came back home and was working on my recuperation when I did have some doctor's appointments I had to go in and out of the university for, and I had suffered a fall due to the fact that I was trying to manipulate physically around and fell over, hit my head, had an ER visit, came back home, thought everything was going to be okay and worked on recuperating. And then lo and behold, on week three post-surgery, I started getting sick. And I just thought it was a simple like cold, but it started out as a sore throat. And then very acutely, 12 hours later, I knew it was something else. I developed what appeared to be flu-like symptoms pretty severely, sinus infection or upper respiratory infection in combination. So this was really odd because it really hit me really hard. And then I called the university a day later because the high fever wouldn't go away. And they had me come in for a COVID test. And sure enough, 6 hours later, I was informed that I was positive. So I... After I had realized that, it was sort of self-solitary confinement, which was very difficult. But on the other end of that, I slept a lot. I didn't eat much because I actually did lose my sense of smell and taste. Fortunately, in my case, it didn't get to the point, with God's grace, that I was so sick that I had to be hospitalized, but I did suffer through with like a terrible sickness and a high fever, and managed to get through it. It took me about 4 weeks to get through it. And then during that time, I was observed and monitored by the respiratory clinic at the University of Iowa. And it took me about 4 weeks until they finally released me. Wow. But in the meantime, I did stumble and go through the motions and did everything I was supposed to do and rested and quarantined. But it was a long haul on top of having to recuperate from a full knee replacement. Although, as sick as I was, I didn't actually, the knee didn't bother me as much as the flu-like symptoms and the achiness. So I don't know.
Yeah. How did your family get through this?
It was difficult because, like I said, I had to kind of self-quarantine or isolate. And I have a 10-year-old son and a husband. And my husband actually had to quarantine as well. He tested, and his test was negative. And then they tested my son 7 days later, and his test was negative. So I honestly, as many precautions as we took, and I couldn't drive at the time, so I wasn't going out and about. Honestly, I have no idea how I contracted it, but as many precautions as we took during the time of this starting, because my husband's career also involves long-term health care. So we were gearing up and taking as many precautions even in the springtime. I even helped out on third shift at the local nursing home because of the fact that things were being shut down and they were low on staff to help in assisted living. But we still took the necessary PPE and precautions and quarantines that we needed to. And then lo and behold, when things kind of lightened up and I was able to kind of get back to somewhat normal, and then I was down for a surgery, I ended up contracting it. And no matter how much you try, safe as we were, we still caught it. So it kind of teaches me never to take anything for granted.
Yeah. Well, and you're living in West Liberty, which is a community that has been hit hard by COVID-19.
Yes.
And it's been particularly hard on the Latino community in West Liberty and the African community in West Liberty. What do you want other people to know about how difficult this has been for so many Iowans that may not be getting the attention that some others are?
Yeah, absolutely. We're a minority-majority population and we're a small town. So out of nearly 4,000 people, you know, we're well over 50% a non-white or Spanish-speaking, you know, minority population. So we do have a large contingent because one of our largest employers happens to be a meat processing plant here in town. And it is very serious thing to think about. And it's something that we don't take lightly here because of that. But I do feel as though that, you know, people of color or people from different cultures are disproportionately affected. I mean, even the, you know, the latest information out there justifies that in facts because of simply for us, because of our place of work. It's difficult because a lot of people that do work in this environment cannot work remotely. So they're already at a risk that maybe some other populations aren't or can't do because of the nature of their work.
Right.
Well, it is significant.
Yeah, Kara, I'm so glad that you're feeling better. And thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Kara McFerrin is a city council member in West Liberty, a mother, a business owner, also a COVID survivor. Courtney Crowder, we only have a couple of minutes left here, and I know that you have shared so many stories about COVID losses in the newspaper with Iowa Mourns. Will you leave us with just a little bit about Dorothy Thompson, Dot Thompson, who could make the best lemon meringue pie in the world?
Yes, that one was really impactful for me because Dot Thompson was 105. And Dot Thompson is a classic farm wife from South Iowa who could make the best lemon meringue pie. She won many blue ribbons for her lemon meringue pie. And her surviving relative was a nephew who told me, you know, she's 105. So it's really easy to look at her and kind of shrug and sort of say, well, you know, she lived a long life. But for him, she was healthy until this virus came. And so for him, it is still important to remember her like any other victim that was harmed by this virus. She might have been 105. She might have lived a great life filled with many lemon meringue pies. But she was culled by the virus just like everyone else. And I think I keep that in mind as we talk about our elderly, because I think it's really easy to kind of say, well, they lived a good life. Like, that's a phrase you hear repeating, but they still maybe were not ready to go.
Yeah.
And really quickly, before you leave, Charity, when we published Iowa Mourns on October 11th, there were 1,400 deaths. So from March 24th to October 11th, there had been 1,400 Iowans who died. Today, like you started the show with, we are a handful away from 2,000. So in the past 5 weeks, we have seen that much of an exponential growth in death that 600 people have died in 5 weeks.
Courtney Crowder, I know you have many more stories to share and to write, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm so grateful that you are doing this project and helping us remember the people lost to COVID-19. Courtney Crowder, thank you.
Thank you. We have to remember. They are names, not numbers.
Courtney Crowder, the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. And please, the numbers continue to climb. It's very dangerous out there, and Thanksgiving is coming soon. It's okay to skip the traditional holiday this year if it means that we can gather together next year. Please be responsible. Please be safe and do what you need to do to take care of yourself and your loved ones. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.